When I was a youth minister in Jackson, my boss started building their family and had a lot of children real quickly. And his wife, Leanne, was just a sweetheart. I mean, she's just wonderful. And she was so good with her kids and yet kind of had that great balance of sweetness and discipline. And one day she had her three-year-old in his room, and he couldn't come out of his room until he had put all of his stuffed animals on the bed where they're supposed to go, you know, just the real basics of picking up after yourself. And he refused to do it. He was just refusing to do it. And, you know, it was like television time or whatever, and he wasn't going to get television time with Barney until he did it. And it kind of, you know how those things kind of spin out of control, these little three-year-olds, and their worlds are falling apart. And he just cried out, "Mommy, I just don't have any love in my heart for you right now." And she looked at him with just sweet compassion and said, "Well, honey, that's okay. I've got enough love in my heart for the both of us." That's a real parenting moment. That's how you respond to your kids. And it's very true. I mean, all of parenting, when you look back on it, it's loving somebody who just doesn't get how much they need to be loved. They just don't get it. I mean, you know, at first, they're born, they kind of look like a lizard, they stare at walls, they don't know who you are, they show absolutely no thanksgiving or love for you, no affection for months, maybe years. You know, they're just needing, selfish machines, calling out, crying, wrecking your sleep, wrecking your schedule, wrecking everything, pretty much. And slowly but surely, you just keep loving them, moving toward their selfishness with compassion, moving toward their rebellion with love, and seeing what they can be, and loving them to become what they can be with the patience of knowing it's going to be years before there's any payback, if there's any at all. That's how the Lord loves us. That's how He's loved me. For most of us, there's been that period in our life, especially for those of us who've grown up in the church, a lot of us share this testimony of there being a time when we tried as hard as we could to rebel. We wanted to get away. We wanted to cry out to God and say, "I'm just tired of you, and I'm tired of your rules. And I want to find something better. I just don't have any love in my heart for you." And finding that he was a lot harder to leave than we thought he was going to be. Years later, we find him saying, "That's okay, I've got enough love for both of us." That's what I want you to see in this text today. Jesus has finished teaching his parables, and we're going into what is the commentators call a period of transition, when he's getting ready to move toward Jerusalem. And during this period, he's being rejected. And we're going to look at three different kinds of rejection and how he responds to them today. Please stand for the reading of God's Word from Matthew 13 and 14. When Jesus had finished these parables, he went away from there, and coming to his hometown, he taught them in their synagogue, so that they were astonished and said, "Where did this man get this wisdom and these mighty works? Is this not the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary, and are not his brothers James and Joseph and Simon and Judas? Are not all his sisters with us? Where then did this man get all these things?" And they took offense at him. But Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor, except in his hometown and in his own household. And he did not do many mighty works there because of their unbelief." At that time, Herod the Tetrarch heard about the fame of Jesus. And he said to his servants, "This is John the Baptist. He has been raised from the dead. This is why these miraculous powers are at work in him." For Herod had seized John and bound him and put him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, because John had been saying to him, "It's not lawful for you to have her." And though he wanted to put him to death, he feared the people because he held him to be a prophet. And when Herod's birthday came, the daughter of Herodias danced before the company and pleased Herod, so that he promised with an oath to give her whatever she might ask. Prompted by her mother, she said, "Give me the head of John the Baptist here on a platter." And the king was sorry, but because of his oaths and his guests, he commanded that it be given. He sent and had John beheaded in prison, and his head was brought on a platter and given to the girl, and she brought it to her mother. And his disciples came and took the body and buried it, and they went and told Jesus. Now when Jesus heard this, he withdrew from there in a boat to a desolate place by himself. But when the crowds heard it, they followed him on foot from the towns. When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them and healed their sick. Thus far, the reading of God's Word. Please be seated. We are looking for reasons to reject Jesus, to reject His demands on our life. And He responds to those rejections with compassion. He moves with compassion toward those who reject Him. Look at the reasons why people reject Him in this text. There's three, and they're familiar, they're ageless. The first reason is just pure familiarity. Familiarity breeding contempt. What Jesus is doing, miracles, He's teaching, He's in Nazareth, where He's grown up, and they say, "Is this not the carpenter's son? Is not His mother called Mary? Where did He get all these things? Where did He learn all this? We know Him." And they reject Him because they know Him. They reject Him because He's familiar to them. And that's a very common thing in our life, isn't it? We want to reject Jesus and the gospel simply because we've heard it so much. It's very problematic in a town like Tulsa when someone's going through a struggle or going through difficulty and they've made bad choices and kind of wrecked their life and become addicted to their sin or whatever it is that's going on, and you want to move toward them and explain to them the grace and the life that Christ offers, but you can't because they just keep hearing those same words that they heard as a child, and they think to themselves, "Look, I know what Jesus has to offer. I know that. And He hasn't helped." Sometimes it's hard for people to move toward the church because all they feel is that shame of their father had put upon them because they were never good enough. And when they think of the church, they think, not only was I not good enough and successful enough, I wasn't moral enough. I wasn't a good enough person. And instead of the church being a place that really relieves their guilt and gives them life, the church becomes a place where they feel their shame. Even after conversion, I had a student and when I was a campus minister, and I just kept pursuing him, and I didn't have very many students who I even knew that year, and so I just kept pursuing the ones I did, and I kept waking him up, and it was pretty funny, actually. But finally, by the end of the year, I'd had enough with him, and I quit meeting with him and told him he was helpless and hopeless, and then the Lord converted him. And so then he came back and said, "Jesus converted me." And that was good, so I didn't get any credit. But I started meeting with him. It was great. And he was just completely new. Everything about him was new. And I said to him, have you shared this with your parents yet?" And he got this stone-cold sober look on his face, and he said, "I can't tell them. I just can't tell them. And they've used the church to beat me up for years. I just can't tell them they were right." That familiarity, it breeds contempt. It's almost embarrassing for us sometimes to have to say, "Yeah, our grandparents were right. They knew something we didn't know." And it makes us want to reject Jesus. Kind of almost that part of growing up, right? That independence. We reject Him because He's familiar. We reject Him just strictly out of love for sin. I mean, why did Herod reject John? It says, "For Herod had seized John, bound him, and put him in prison for the sake of his brother Philip's wife, because John had been saying to him, 'It's not lawful for you to have her.'" Sometimes we do just get faced with that black and white choice. If Jesus is God, I can't live this way, and I'm going to live this way, so I'm going to reject Jesus. It sounds not very sophisticated, but at the end of the day, we're not that sophisticated. Tim Keller in New York was asked, what's the main real threat for the church today? What's the hurdle for the church today, in the 21st century? And he's always, very insightful, expecting something philosophical, probably, about postmodernism or whatever. And he just said, sex. And the reporter said, what do you mean? And he said, look, we live in a culture where not a single unbeliever is sexually moral. And almost no single, and no believers who are single are sexually moral. And we simply can't expect God to be at work in a church where sexual morality is not taken seriously. And the Bible does make those claims on us. And we know that, right? And it's hard. And it's not as simple as just believe and don't do that. I mean, for many of us, our sin becomes part of us. We just can't imagine life without it. It becomes the way you deal with life. I love when Russell Brand was asked about addictions. He said he was a heroin addict for many years and still is. And he says, look, heroin's not my problem. Life is my problem. Heroin is how I deal with it. And that's the way it is for many of us. Maybe it's not, probably not heroin, I would imagine, too much in this room. But pornography. Life just becomes so depressing, so hard that the only thing you enjoy is that fantasy world that you've created. Or the only thing that you enjoy is closing the door with a box of cookies to yourself. Or the only thing you enjoy is that drink at the end of the day. It's the only thing that brings you pleasure. It's the thing that gets you through life. Sometimes we just reject Jesus because we know we can't have Him and have the one thing that we want. It really is that simple sometimes. Sometimes we reject Jesus because of the group around us. It's interesting just how savage this group gets. It's hard for us to imagine having a big party that gets so lusty, that gets so just gross, that you would bring the head of a man out on a platter as the climax of the party. But this group, they all obviously are into it. They've heard the oath. They've heard the request. And they all feel convicted by this prophet. They all feel like, yeah, to death with the one who would tell us to not enjoy the pleasures of our flesh. And as a group, they were willing to do what Herod himself wouldn't even do personally. That group mentality. Driving people to do what they wouldn't do as an individual. Now, there's been a court case in Mississippi this month. You may probably haven't heard about it much, but it's this group of boys that one weekend night thought it would be really fun to go beat up an African American. And so they went and jumped this guy, a security guard at a hotel, and they beat him up. And then when they were left him laying bleeding in the parking lot, they drove over him. And just to make sure they drove over him, they backed over him again and they killed him. And the interesting thing was after the trial, they were convicted, obviously. I mean, it was all on security camera. They had no defense. Their only defense was just to flood the judge with character witnesses. These are good boys. They shouldn't be punished with their whole life. They shouldn't get life in prison. They shouldn't get the death penalty. And the character witness letters came in from their pastors and their youth ministers saying, I know these boys. They're good boys. If you only knew what they were like alone. But when they get together as a group, they're savage. Now, C.S. Lewis wrote just a great speech that he delivered at Oxford at graduation one year. And he said to the group, some of you are going to do awful things. You're going to do something terrible. And you're not going to, you hear that right now and you're offended by the thought, and you're never going to intentionally do it, but your desire to get into the inner ring of some group is going to be so strong that when you get close to that ring and one of the members of that inner ring looks at you and says, well, this is how we do things, you're just going to do it naturally because this is how we do it. It's that power of the ring, that power of the group that's it drives us really insane. We do things that we would never have done. And when we're in a group that's rejected righteousness, that's rejected the gospel, we know that. We've experienced that. And we get into the group. That's those are the reasons we reject Him. And I love Jesus' response to the rejection. He says, when Jesus heard this, He withdrew from there in a boat to a desolate place by Himself. He went to mourn. He went to mourn His friend. Went to mourn just the evilness of the world that He was in. But the crowds heard it, and they followed Him on foot from the towns. And He went ashore, and He saw a great crowd. And think about what Jesus sees when He sees this crowd. He knows how fickle they are. He's felt the rejection. He knows, in some level, He knows that there's going to be crowds calling for His crucifixion one day. And what does it say? He had compassion on them, and He healed their sick. The crowds that reject Him, the crowds that ultimately would betray Him, that would leave Him, His own disciples who would betray Him and who would deny knowing Him, are the ones that He comes back for after the crucifixion. He moves toward them. He moves toward them with compassion. And the beautiful thing about this whole period, it's funny. When you're reading commentaries, you know, what commentators want to do more than anything else is make sense of everything, kind of put it in a nice little literary package and explain it to you. And when they have no idea what to call a couple of chapters, they come up with phrases like transitional. So chapters 14, 15, and 16 of Matthew are transitional. We don't know what to call them. He was teaching. He's about to teach again. And this is a transition when it looks like basically Matthew is just reading Mark and copying it, which really was what it looks like. But the transition's important because up until now he's been teaching in Galilee. And after this transition, he's going to turn his face toward Jerusalem. And he's going to go there to die. He's going to go there to die for His people. That's how He responds to rejection. That's how He responds to rebellion. That's how He responds to bloodthirst. By turning His face toward Jerusalem to die for His people. To take their sin on. Because you see, He doesn't look upon our sin like this great evil perpetrated by powerful people. He looks upon us like children who just don't know. We just don't know. We don't know what we're rejecting. We want so badly to cast off our parents and be independent. And we're like my four-year-old. I asked one of my kids once, I said, did you ever run away from home? And one of them said, yeah, I ran away. I said, well, how far did you get? He said, well, I got to the overpass, which is about half a mile from the house. I said, why'd you come back? He said, well, I got hungry. And so then I came back and I ate some lunch. I was going to run away after lunch. I thought, well, I'll just go back and eat some lunch and then I'll run away. But then I got back and I ate lunch and I just kind of forgot about it. You know, we're so familiar with Christ, we want to just get away from Him. And His response is, you're going to come back. At the end of the day, you know, this is the only place to get a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. You know. He just looks at us with compassion. And he even kind of throws his bones every now and then. It's really, really funny. I think one of the reasons why God has given the church the reformed theology is so that some of us can run away from our parents but still be Christians, but we're a different kind of Christian, right? We're reformed Christians, so we're different from you, but we still believe 99% of the same stuff. He's just being gentle. He looks at our addictions, our sins. And instead of covering us with shame, he sees them for what they are. He knows that we're weak. And we think, you know, this momentary pleasure is going to make life worth living. And he just feels sorry for us. And he patiently endures with us. And some of us, he lets us reach the bottom. He lets us just go to the end of where that sin will allow us. He really lets most of us go that far, and then he slowly draws us back, showing us that he still loves us. And after all the sexual immorality leaves us feeling guilty or sad or lonely or ashamed, he brings us back from that shame. And he dresses us with his glory. And he not only forgives us, but he says to you, I accept you and I love you and I think you are beautiful. And he doesn't just scold us, telling us to get rid of this sin that's wrong, but he looks at us and he says, let me heal your life so you won't need it anymore. Let me give you fellowship so you won't feel so lonely that going off into your closet and closing the door and being alone is the only place where you feel comfortable anymore. Let me change you. Let me give you hope. And he looks at our group think. He looks at the savagery that we find that we're capable of. And he says, let me give you a new family. And when we're willing to, stop lying, he's there. He moves toward us with compassion. The problem is to receive that compassion, we have to do something that hurts. We have to admit that every sin that we committed, we did it because we wanted to. It wasn't because of the group. It wasn't because of how depressing our life was. It was because our belief in him was weak. We just didn't believe he was really enough for us, and we wanted to. And that is ugly, and that is awful. That is a hard thing to admit. But when we admit it, I love Mel Gibson describes it as embracing the cactus. When we embrace the cactus of who we are, he comes forward and he heals the wounds. And he's there. And he loves us enough for both of us. Please pray with me. Father in heaven, we confess that we have spent our lives, most of us, trying to find ways to replace you. Replace you with a group that is just more concrete, closer to us, more just makes us feel better about who we are. We've tried to replace you with independence and new things. We've tried to replace you with sins that just feel better than worship does, feel better than you do.